Hope everybody enjoyed President's Day. This episode of The Far Middle is first going to air on Ash Wednesday. So to all of my fellow Catholics, welcome to Lent. Now, for those constant listeners who are not Catholic, Ash Wednesday is the start of Lent, runs 40 days till Easter, and it mirrors the 40 days and nights spent in the wilderness by Jesus as he fought temptation from the devil. And it's a tradition during this time to give something up and to make, for lack of a better term, a personal sacrifice over the next 40 days. It's interesting how a Catholic tradition that stretches back for who knows how long is the modern day sort of equivalent or consistent with the modern day obsession that we see in society about wellness. And that sort of strikes me as the same concept. And what I mean is that typically things that are given up for Lent are some sort of guilty pleasure in the food category. So a lot of people will give up chocolate or they'll forego wine or beer over the next 40 days, which mirrors much of the wellness effort and craze that's out there today. For instance, there's all these New Year's resolutions that you hear about, the dry Januaries where people don't drink alcohol for the entire month of January. Well, in mid-February, if you're Catholic and you're going to give up alcohol for Lent, you add it up to the dry January that you started on New Year's, and you're starting to push a third of the year. So don't know if that makes you healthier or not. I've seen studies saying red wine reduces heart risk and others saying it creates health risks. Experts, you know, you got to love them. But for all you Catholic constant listeners, good luck with whatever you're giving up over the next 40 days. Hope you stick to it. But let's make sure that you're not foregoing listening to The Far Middle over Lent. Not listening might not elevate to a sin, but it would certainly be a shame. Let's drive on to discussing what we will dedicate episode 92 of The Far Middle to in the world of sports. My process for thinking through this dedication was an interesting one, and I wanted to share it with you. I initially was debating in my mind between two of my favorite athletes for the dedication. First being the Minister of Defense, Reggie White. He was the Mean Joe Green of his era. And the second being Rick Tocchet of NHL fame, an all-time favorite of mine who wore 92 when he played for the Pittsburgh Penguins. And as I was debating which one of these two to go with, or whether maybe to co-dedicate, I started to think about the essence of what I loved about both of these athletes. And I settled on a common trait that they both shared, which was a tenacity for greatness. Now, tenacity, you look it up, it's defined as the quality of continuing to exist. So tenacity for greatness would be the quality of continuing to exist at a level of greatness over a long period of time. Now, there is the technical definition of tenacity, but then there is the eye test for tenacity. You know tenacity in a competitive sport when you see it. You don't need a dictionary. And Tocchet and Reggie White, they certainly passed the eye test for tenacity. And that's when I got to thinking that maybe we need to dedicate episode 92 to tenacity for greatness and name some of the key athletes across major sports who exuded that tenacity for greatness. So Rick Tocchet certainly fits the bill. 18 seasons, skilled hockey player, never, ever afraid to face confrontation. He's the type of player, and you'll be able to say this for just about every name I'm about to go through, that you may despise when he's playing against your team, but you would love to have him on your team. Reggie White, of course, is another example of tenacity for greatness. 15 seasons, rarely hurt, playing in one of the most demanding positions in all of sports. In the world of basketball, two names that came to mind immediately when I thought of tenacity for greatness. Dennis Rodman was the first one, 14 years of nothing but 100%+ when he was on the court, particularly with his defensive play and rebounding abilities. And then the second name, Allen Iverson. The player that took a beating game in and game out, but just had a desire to get to the hoop and to score. Love that press conference with Iverson when they were asking him about missing practice. We're talking about practice, not a game. That's classic. In baseball, I got two names to add to the tenacity for greatness list. You got Pete Rose and Carlton Fisk. Both played 24 years. Pete Rose was rarely hurt, and Carlton Fisk, he was injured at times because he backed down from nothing and no one at the plate. Now, one more name to the football list, and it hurts me to say this as a Steelers fan, is Ray Lewis. 17 years playing at his intensity, it seems almost non-human. And I'm not, you know, a big fan about some of the baggage that Ray Lewis had off the field, but on the field, you have to acknowledge, you know, what he did in his play. And one more name on the hockey list to add to Tocchet, and that is the great eight, Alex Ovechkin. We've talked about him and dedicated episodes to him in the past. The guy is the Energizer Bunny, going on 18-plus seasons. yeah, he can score goals, no doubt about that. The numbers show it. But he plays a very, very physical game, and he never shies away from contact, and he's rarely injured. So there you have our dedication for episode 92, Tenacity for Greatness. Dennis Rodman, Allen Iverson, Reggie White, Ray Lewis, Pete Rose, Carlton Fisk, Rick Tocchet, and Alex Ovechkin. Off and running for episode 92. That means we start making connections on the playing field of sports. There's that tenacity for greatness. But then on the playing field of competitive nations and geopolitics, there is tenacity for scientific greatness. And I want to talk a bit about the topic of scientific greatness and whether America still has the fortitude and the drive to exhibit a tenacity for scientific greatness. Now, on the surface, America's scientific prowess, it looks better than ever. There's more scientists than ever, or maybe I should qualify that by saying that there are more people who warrant or consider themselves scientists. There are more scientific publications than ever, again, with the caveat of more and more people taking wider and wider liberties defining what constitutes science publication. When you look at the number of papers published, you reach the same conclusion because there are more papers being published in the United States than ever before. And certainly from a financial perspective, we are throwing epic levels of dollars at scientific research. Federal funding alone for R&D is almost $140 billion a year. That's a tenfold increase from the mid-1950s, even after you adjust for inflation and put the numbers in real dollar terms. So more scientists than ever, more publications in the field of science than ever, more technical papers than ever, and more taxpayer dollars thrown at research and development than ever. You consider those metrics, and a reasonable person comes to the conclusion that we've never been stronger in the field of science than we are as a nation today. But we all know the statistics could be misleading, and sometimes statistics can outright lie. And that is the case when it comes to America's scientific efficacy, because we're getting worse and moving in the wrong direction, not getting better and moving in the right direction. Let me tell you why. There's a metric that's been developed to track the efficacy of science and research and development over time, and it's called the Consolidation Disruption Index, or CD Index. The CD index measures the impact that research will have once it's published. So the CD index, it pivots off of how often a scientific work is referenced by other researchers in papers. So if a scientist publishes a simple rehash of an area of research everyone already knows about, very few other researchers will reference the work in their papers, and the CD index is going to be low. But if a scientist publishes a groundbreaking innovation or discovery, it's going to kick off all kinds of other research efforts. And when those papers get published, they're going to surely reference the original work, resulting in a high CD index. CD index is a metric to measure the impact of the research paper. Does it impact others and advance the state of the art, or is it basically nothing new? That's what the CD index seeks to capture. The most common measure of CD index is what's known as the CD5, which looks to measure the consolidation disruption index of a scientific paper 5 years after its publication. So that's a CD5. Now, here's where things get troubling, because the CD5 index hasn't just been flat the last number of years, and it hasn't just been declining slightly the past number of years. It's been plummeting when it comes to American science the past number of years. Just consider the following results for the CD5 index. In the social sciences, the CD5 index dropped from 0.52 in 1945, just after World War II, to 0.04 in 2010. That's more than a 90% drop in the CD5 index in the field of social sciences from the end of World War II to today. Now, when I first saw that index over time, I sort of discounted it because, as many constant listeners know, I'm not exactly what you would call a fan of what the social sciences have become today. It's become more of a political science field than a scientific field as it relates to social behavior. But then I saw the CD5 index for an area of research that I have high respect for, which are the physical sciences. And the results from 1945 to 2020 didn't just alarm me, they depressed me as an engineer. Because the CD5 index in the physical sciences, it went from 0.36 in 1945 to 0 in 2020. That's right, 0 was the CD5 index for American research in the physical sciences in 2020. That's not just a problem, that's a crisis. And if you think this consolidation disruption index when it comes to scientific research is only impacting and of importance to a very, very small segment of society who are basically stuck in laboratories, you need to think again. The best way I can illustrate that for you is to quote you the CD5 index performance for the field of drugs and medical patents. The average CD5 decreased from 0.38 in 1980 to 0.03 in 2010. Now, I don't have more recent data than 2010, but the field of drugs and medical patents, that represents innovations and technological advancements that will affect the lives of every single one of us, along with all of our families and friends. But it gets worse, and it gets more depressing, because the one field of science that I would have expected the best showing for CD5 over time would be in the area of computer and communications patents. So if you believe only a fraction of the hype about how impressive and brilliant the tech sector is in this nation, you'd expect the CD5 index in the field of computers and communications patents to basically be skyrocketing. It's the new economy, it's the future, right? We've heard all those things. Well, it may be the new economy, and it might be the future, but America is in trouble because the CD5 for computer and communications patents decreased from 0.3 in 1980 to 0.06 in 2010. That's an 80% decline, and a shocking one at that. So what is going on with the state of scientific research in our society? I've got a few theories as to the root causes to share with you, and they all tie back to themes that are discussed in my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, which I encourage you to give a read to if you get a chance. And if you're so inclined to, you can purchase it on Amazon. And the first root cause of this precipitous drop in the Consolidation Disruption Index for scientific research, it goes back to those dollars that I mentioned at the beginning of this topic, a 10-plus-fold increase in tax dollars adjusted for inflation by federal funding into research and development since 1955. More dollars does not equate to more output or more return when it comes to government funding of any private sector or free market endeavor. We've seen it time and time again. Think of public education. We throw more taxpayer money per student than ever, and yet math and reading and science proficiencies of students, particularly poor students in urban school districts, they are absurdly embarrassing for an advanced society that says education is a priority like ours. Think of public transportation. Hundreds of billions, now adding up to trillions of dollars of taxpayer money, poured into big city public transportation networks. Yet those networks are less reliable than ever, they're more dangerous than ever, they're more costly than ever, and they are less efficient than ever. Example after example exists across society where government funding is not just wasteful without a return to taxpayer investment, but it actually makes the thing that it is funding worse. We waste money, and we make the focal point of the funding worse off than it would have been without the funding. The very same thing is happening with scientific research, as proven by the results we just discussed for the CD5 indices over time. Government intervenes through the power of the purse, and efficacy, it instantly begins to drop off substantially. The second root cause, it's a bit of a derivative root cause coming off of government intervention and funding into research. And that is that once government becomes the funding source, then the special interests and the ideologies that government favor, they begin to dictate the type of research that's conducted, and by the way, how it's conducted, to the point where it's no longer science, but it becomes gamed research to produce a desired result in a world of political science. When you start doing that across the entire research community that depends on government nearly exclusively for funding, what would you expect? The first thing you'd expect would be a bunch of groupthink in papers that just restate and repeat the accepted view or conclusion or ideology, and if everyone's saying the same thing in their technical papers, then the referencing of research papers by others is going to drop because there's nothing unique or new or advanced anymore. It's all just readily available anywhere you look. And the second thing you'd expect would be freezing the state of the art. Progress and innovation would come to a grinding halt because the entire system is funded and designed to produce the same conclusions over and over again, basically to reinforce the accepted consensus. And thus, lack of progress and breakthroughs in the state of the art, that's what's driving the consolidation and disruptive index lower. Now, the third root cause, it's playing a major role with our declining scientific research efficacy, and it speaks to that word that I just used, consensus, or more specifically, the problem of scientific consensus. scientific consensus it grips today's scientific community in the West, and that is a major problem and area of concern. We've talked about the flaw of scientific consensus in prior episodes of The Far Middle, and I've often referenced the great author Michael Crichton with his brilliant summation of the flaw and the folly of scientific consensus. Science is about breaking and challenging consensus, but when government or the state is the primary funding source of research, you can be sure that those dollars come with ideological strings attached, and those ideological strings demand strict adherence to a nearly religious zealotry that conforms with the scientific consensus. Climate change is the biggest existential threat facing humanity today. Vaccines are this or vaccines are that. Green building design, it's got a great economic payoff. Wind and solar, right, they're renewable and they're zero carbon sources of energy. Island nations are disappearing before our very eyes, and on and on. If a researcher conducts research that concludes anything even remotely challenging to the ideological scientific consensus of today, on whatever matter or in whatever field, the funding will be revoked and the paper will face a tough path to any sort of publication. It's not just scientific consensus anymore. It's frankly feeling more and more like a fundamentalist religion, and that religion seems to look a lot like the religion of the left. Okay, let's shift gears, moving from one big problem in scientific research to yet another big problem. I mentioned at the start of the conversation on scientific research efficacy that federal funding for R&D is approaching $140 billion a year. And government spending has been exploding everywhere you look, not just with respect to R&D, to the point where it's not approaching a crisis, but it has reached a crisis. We're well beyond approaching a crisis. And it is a crisis of simple math, so I want to give you some of that math. Since President Biden took office, government debt is up by $3.7 trillion. That is unbelievable and at a pace never seen before. But this was a math problem well before the current president, because since February 2020, when President Trump was in office, government debt is up $8 trillion, which is even more extreme. A big part of the math problem is recognizing that not only is debt level growing, but the cost of paying interest on that debt, it's going up substantially. It's a horrible cycle that was self-inflicted. So step one was government spending excessive amounts of money and running up huge deficits. That started to stoke inflationary fires all across the economy. You couple that with step two, which was our central bank, the Federal Reserve, setting interest rates at zero or close to it, and basically having real interest rates at substantial negative levels. That stoked the inflationary fires even more. And then once inflation takes off and it's raging out of control, suddenly the central bank needs to raise interest rates to tame inflation, and the higher interest rates hit the federal government budget at the worst possible time, meaning when debt levels are the highest. Consider this: gross interest payments on federal government debt, it's approaching $1 trillion a year, $1 trillion a year, just to pay the interest on federal government debt. I saw this statistic as well that gave me great concern. Nearly half of all of our outstanding debt, government debt, matures within the next 3 years. And when that debt matures and it's refinanced, right, the interest rates are going to be much higher on the new debt because of what interest rates have done over the past couple of years. So you can see why we're approaching $1 trillion a year in interest payments. It's a brutal and basic math problem, as I said, that has only a few simple solutions. One solution is to raise taxes to pay down debt, but you can only do so much of that without wrecking the economy. Another option is to cut spending and entitlements to eliminate deficits that are adding to the debt. But there's no political stomach for that these days. The direction actually is in the opposite direction, with more and more spending and entitlements that are being granted almost every day, it seems. And then the third option is that the government can simply default on its debt obligations, which of course would be a calamity. But it's a guaranteed path, that is default, if the prior options are not taken or considered. So the longer we wait on those first two paths, the higher the chance of default will be, and it's going to be, in the end, the only path that we have to choose from. And by the way, the talk of having the Fed cut interest rates so that it lightens the budget burden of interest payments on the federal debt, that's not a solution. That's not an answer. It's a delaying tactic that kicks the can down the road but makes things worse because it delays the drive for needed fiscal reform. But I'll bet you that is exactly the tactic that will be tried first. The argument will be, hey, Inflation is coming down and high interest rates are hurting the little guy, so let's cut interest rates again. The government debt will grow, the Fed's going to lose its credibility, and the capital markets are going to lose trust and confidence. The end path takes you right back to default. Now, DC says it needs the ability to raise debt and debt ceilings more and more with no strings attached. Irresponsibility in Washington is weaving a fiscal noose around our collective necks, and the president is to blame. Prior presidents are to blame. Congress is to blame. Democrats are to blame. Republicans are to blame. In the end, we, the voters and the taxpayers who put them all there, are in part to blame as well. So let's engage in public discourse on this matter because it's really an important one to all of us. You know, it didn't used to be this way with the federal government debt and how government and Congress and the president figured budget expenditures out. LBJ took over the White House just after, of course, JFK's assassination. And he wanted to follow through with much of Kennedy's programs because he felt it paid respect to the late president and it helped the nation heal and move on. So Johnson wanted a tax cut, but in the Senate, there was a fiscal hawk by the name of Harry Byrd. Senator Byrd was a conservative from Virginia, a Democrat, and he chaired the powerful Senate Finance Committee. Lyndon Johnson, of course, was also a Democrat. And what we would find strange today is that the Democrat Johnson wanted a tax cut. Anyway, Johnson, the president, calls Senator Byrd to the White House, and he tells him that he needs this tax cut. Byrd tells him that he understands, but that he's not going to get this tax cut unless they rein in the federal budget. So President Johnson says he understood, and they start to horse trade over what budget expenditure number they would agree upon to go with basically the tax cut. So President Johnson, he throws out maybe being able to get down to a $105 billion budget. And Senator Byrd said that was much too large of a budget. The two of them ultimately settled at a federal budget that would be just under $100 billion. And off they went and found a way, both holding to their word. I want you to think about that from two perspectives. The first being what it was like when government used to work together on behalf of the interests of American citizens. And the second being the magnitude of numbers, you know, how the math has changed when it comes to government spending. A $100 billion federal budget in the early to mid-1960s, today's annual federal spending is in excess of $6 trillion. That's a 60-fold increase in federal budget expenditures since the start of LBJ's reign. Do you think government has become anything close to 60 times more effective since the early days of LBJ's tenure in the White House? We are just about out of time for episode 92. I hope you enjoyed this one. We started out talking about wellness and giving something up that was a guilty pleasure and maybe not good for your health for Lent. And we talked about, in our sports dedication, that tenacity for greatness. Well, let's wrap this episode by connecting back with those two themes that we started this episode with. It's yet another full circle of connections on the far middle. There's a birthday coming up this week, and it's the birthday for a Hollywood legend that was known as the Great One. How many of you constant listeners know who the Great One was in Hollywood? The answer is Jackie Gleason. He got the nickname the Great One from another Great One, Orson Welles. Jackie Gleason was not the picture of wellness, and he would not have a tough time listing things he might want to give up for 40 days when it came to something like Lent or wellness. He smoked 5 packs of cigarettes a day. He was a heavy drinker. He had a challenge with weight throughout much of his life, but he was larger than life, and he achieved greatness across a range of different entertainment avenues. Just think about this. So first, he was hugely successful on television in the 1950s and 60s. His role as Ralph Cramden on The Honeymooners, it was one of the greatest roles in the history of television. I didn't know this until recently, but The Honeymooners, they only ran for a single season on TV in 1955. And if you ever get a chance to watch some of the old reruns, you'll be really happy that you invested the time. They do not make TV like that anymore. And what made Ralph Cramden and The Honeymooners so watchable was that you were looking at basically a loser with respect to every measurable metric in life. But he was a loser who kept on trying. He keeps getting up when life throws him down. And his wife and his friends, they loved him for it. To me, Ralph Cramden is the epitome of the working class hero. Now, Gleason had sort of a second avenue of greatness and success. He excelled on the big screen as well. Now, his most critically acclaimed role in a movie may have been playing Pool Shark Minnesota Fats in The Hustler alongside Paul Newman. But my favorite role of Jackie Gleason on the big screen was his part in Smokey and the Bandit alongside Burt Reynolds and Sally Field. What was the name of Gleason's hapless sheriff in Smokey and the Bandit? That's right, Buford T. Justice. But here's an aspect of Jackie Gleason's talent that that most people don't even realize. He was a hugely successful music producer. The Jackie Gleason Orchestra specialized in the genre of mood music. So that was basically romantic instrumentals played by orchestras. Gleason produced 60 albums, and he had the first album in history to chart in the top 10 for over 150 weeks. Jackie Gleason was a music mogul on par with another great that we discussed a few episodes ago, that being Quincy Jones. One last factoid about Jackie Gleason. His grandson is the actor Jason Patrick. Whatever happened to Jason Patrick? Great actor in the 90s, but haven't seen much of him since. Anyway, they don't make them like Jackie Gleason anymore, and they didn't make anybody like Jackie Gleason prior. That's why he's known as the Great One. I hope you have a good week. Don't be shy about striving with a tenacity for greatness, and I will see you with episode 93.